Good evening. My name is Perry Hoffman, and I'm president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. This is our eighth call out of our first 10 of this first series, and we are already working on our second series with a lot of excitement with people who want to be on, who want to be presenters. So we're absolutely thrilled about that. And we're very lucky tonight to have Dr. Shireen Rizvi, who will be doing her own introduction because she's done so much that I couldn't even keep up with what she's done. I also do want to ask people again, remind them that we're not for profit. We don't charge for things, and every donation that all of you make ensures that we can keep doing these kinds of programs. So please do take a minute, go on our website, and send in a donation. That's most appreciated. All right, Shireen, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I want to thank Perry and her group for inviting me to do this talk. I feel like every time I turn around, there's something new and innovative coming out from NEA BPD and free. I always direct my graduate students to the NEA BPD website just because it's kind of an embarrassment of riches over there in terms of all the collection of goodies you have on your website now, including these talks. So thank you so much for involving me and involving IZIT-DBT. I want to thank also all the presenters from IZIT-DBT whose work I'll be summarizing during the course of this call. I don't even know if some of them might even be on this call, but I wanted to, of course, acknowledge them because if it were not for their fabulous presentations, I would have nothing to present to you. My name is Shireen Rizvi. I am an assistant professor of clinical psychology at Rutgers University. For the past couple of years, 2010-2011, I've also been the program chair of IZIT-DBT, which means I've been responsible for essentially making the conference day happen. My tenure is up, and I get to send it along to somebody else, and I'll tell you about that at the end of this call. So that's been one of the tasks that I've done, but that's been a volunteer task. My primary job is my job at Rutgers, where I teach graduate students and mentor graduate students and run my own DBT program there. That's really a training clinic where I train graduate students in how to do DBT, and we are able to offer very low-cost treatment to individuals in the community who are looking for comprehensive DBT. And I also conduct research in a variety of areas related to DBT down there as well. So when Perry asked me to give a review of IZIT-DBT, I was delighted to, in part because I know that I've received a number of emails from folks when I was putting together the program saying that they were unable to attend and they really wished that we had recordings, and I just couldn't get my act together to make recordings from IZIT-DBT and to do all that's necessary to make that happen. So this gives me an opportunity to summarize for those of you that couldn't make it. However, I do have to make a couple of caveats, which is just to say that it is hard to summarize one full day of events in less than an hour. Also difficult because in the afternoon we have three different workshops all happening at the same time, so it's not just one full day, it's actually probably the equivalent of 1.5 days I have to summarize in less than an hour. And also, since I was program chair, I was in and out of several sessions, had to miss a fair amount. So I apologize in advance for any errors or misinterpretations of the day that I may have made or that I may make along the way. And so to that end, I also want to thank some folks for providing me with info from the sessions I might have missed, Sarah Reynolds and Charlie Swenson, both DBT experts, and my student volunteers who were there all day who gave me some info. So I wanted to note that. Perry, they all have the slides, so I can just, when I move on to a slide, just let them know what I'm doing. Is that how it works?
Yes, and anybody who doesn't have the handouts, please email neabpd@aol.com. Yes, but everybody should have them.
Great. Okay, so now I'm on the second slide, and I just wanted to, I was just talking with Perry before we officially started about the history of IZIT-DBT. Many of you may know this already, but IZIT-DBT stands for the International Society for the Improvement and Teaching of DBT. It's a volunteer organization with the sole task of putting on an annual conference until this year. There have been some changes, and so I will get to that at the end of this call. But that's basically what this organization has been about, is putting on an annual conference. And the first conference was held in 1996, and it was chaired by Charlie Swenson, who many of you know or have listened to on these calls. 16 years later, we had our last conference on November 10th in Toronto with, actually, this is, 220 participants in attendance. The conference is always held. It has the same, not the same date, but it's always held at the same time every year. It's held the Thursday right before the annual conference of the Association of Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, or ABCT, which is typically a Friday through Sunday conference. Linehan and Charlie and others who formed the TBT were very clear about the necessity of doing that. You know, we always have from the beginning talked about how DBT is fundamentally a behavior therapy. And so they put the Is a DBT conference on the Thursday with the hopes that people who are coming in for the behavioral conference can come to Is a DBT, and that DBT practitioners would stay for the ABCT conference. And so we always give a discount to folks. We're a separate organization, and so we do registration separately, but we always give a discount for folks who are also registered for the ABCT conference. We just see the link between those two things as being so fundamental. We have a website, which is isitdbt.org, and so you can go there anytime to find out information about the next upcoming conference and also information about previous conferences. Okay, so I am on the next slide, which is just a summary of the day's events, and I believe that you also have accessible to you in a handout, is the actual handout of the schedule of this past year's Is a DBT. This is just kind of a summary slide. We actually started with a mindfulness exercise that Randy Wolbert led. Basically, the way, in my capacity as the program chair, I've opened up the day's events to submissions by everyone, and then I use the program committee to choose the presenters. So I opened up for submissions for the research panel and submissions for the afternoon clinical workshops. And this was different than most of the previous years. In the previous years, the chair may have handpicked the workshop presenters or handpicked the folks that they knew had recent data to present at the research panel. I can't say honestly which is better or worse in terms of making a more well-rounded day, but I think that what I enjoyed about this process of kind of making it more open to the broader DBT community to submit abstracts and present is that we may have heard from folks that might not otherwise be in the radar of the chair, so to speak. So we had a keynote address, and I'll tell you more about this, by Leslie Greenberg, who is not a DBT person at all. He is the developer of a therapy called emotion-focused therapy. We had a follow-up to the keynote by Kelly Kerner, who is a DBT expert, and I asked her to present a short talk to really talk about the similarities and differences between Dr. Greenberg's approach to DBT, and so she did a fantastic job of that. I believe you have her slides. We had a research panel in the morning, which had three presentations on data about DBT, and there was kind of a theme for this year's research panel, which was DBT in clinical practice, and two of the three talks had conducted research in the realm of private practice, and I'll tell you more about their data, but it's an interesting endeavor to say the least, and usually unappreciated. We had three afternoon clinical workshops, which I'll summarize, and then we had an annual address. We always have an address by Marcia Linehan at the end of the day. This year's address was on the topic of certification and accreditation, and I'm guessing some of you are calling in now because you're interested in that specific topic, so I will make sure that I have time at the end to review what she talked about during her address. We also, this is sort of part of the fun of Is a DBT as well, is that we have an award presentation every year, and then we have a poster session in conjunction with a cocktail hour, which really allows for people to mix and to network and to unwind at the end of the day. So all in all, and this year was no exception, it's a very fun day. You get to interact with a lot of folks, several of the trainers in DBT and some of the leading experts in DBT go. Marcia goes every year, and so it's just a fun conference, and I hope all of you who are on this call look into coming in the future. I decided to skip over and present, or at least just mention up front, the awards from this year, but just take a minute to do so, just to give you the exciting news that we presented an award that's called the Cindy Sanderson Outstanding Educator Award. This year it went to Dr. Linda DeMess, who is a DBT trainer, DBT treatment developer in the area of DBT for substance use, and a phenomenal researcher on developing training methods to enhance, empirically driven training methods to enhance therapists' capabilities. And so we presented her at the end of the day with this award, which is named after Cindy Sanderson, who some of you probably know as an amazing trainer who passed away several years ago. Linda was very touched by receiving this award. She gave a very touching speech, and it really meant a lot to the community to see her get this award. For the first time this year, and I hope that it continues in future years, we also gave a research award for a student. Basically, we opened up the poster presentation. Anybody who was a first author on a poster and submitted that to be accepted into our poster presentation section was eligible for the award. So this year, the award went to a student at UCLA named Rachel Higier for her poster entitled Predictors of Burnout in DBT, Dialectical Dilemmas and Therapy Interfering Behaviors. So I just wanted to honor those two folks before we get into the content. Okay. So I am on my next slide, which is to talk about the keynote address. So I had heard Dr. Greenberg, Les Greenberg, present at an event in New Jersey in 2009, a couple of years ago, and knew that he was from Toronto. He is a professor at York University in Toronto, and after I heard him speak, I knew that we just had to get him for this year's is a DBT since it was held in Toronto, and he graciously agreed, and I was just really pleased about that. So he, I'm going to function as though this is unfamiliar to all of you. He developed a therapy called emotion-focused therapy, and I believe it was originally developed in the 80s, probably around the same time that DBT was developed, but in non-overlapping areas. So he and you can find resources at emotionfocusedtherapy.org. He has a lot of resources up there. So as you might gather from the title, a lot of his treatment has to do with working with emotions within the context of therapy, so working with emotions in therapy, moment-by-moment tracking of people's emotions in sessions, and he uses the notion of that it's really important to have emotional experiencing occur in therapy, and that's only when it's occurring in therapy can you actually work with it in therapy. And so he has this expression that he uses that you need to feel it in order to heal it. And so that's one of the quotes that was given during the talk, that this is how an EFT therapist might think, is that that's something that you need to have show up in the context of the therapy session. He is a proponent of the use of the two-chair technique, which is a Gestalt technique, which, if you're not familiar, has the person sit in one chair and talk to the other chair, the empty chair, as though they were sitting in it, and then they go to the other chair, the one that had been empty, and they sit in it and they reflect upon what it was like to have heard what was just said from the position of the other chair. And so he uses that a lot as a way of evoking some of this emotional experiencing within session. He also, this is similar to DBT, he talked about the importance of differentiating primary emotions from secondary emotions, where secondary emotions are the reaction to the primary emotion, that primary emotions can be both adaptive or maladaptive, and so you want to differentiate that as well. And also he talked about the a third type of an emotion, which we don't really talk about in DBT, which is instrumental emotion, and how he frames an instrumental emotion is doing something when you're aware of the aim. So having an emotion in order to influence somebody else, and you're doing that with awareness, like I am being angry in order to bully someone. So he thinks it's incredibly important to do a lot of assessment about the nature of the emotion, which I think we would say is very similar to DBT, that we do a lot of assessment about emotion as well. He talks about the novel approach to EFT, I think, is that he talks about how you change and work with emotions, is that you change emotions with another emotion. You transform an emotion with another emotion. And so what he would say is that although you can't change the past, you can change your experience of a memory from the past. So, for example, if you have childhood sexual abuse in your history and you experience a lot of shame about that, what you can do is transform the shame to anger. Like by asking the person, what did they need in that moment? The person might say, I needed to be validated. And the therapist might say, yes, and you deserve that validation. And the client would say, yes, I deserve that validation. So the client feels healthy anger. And then the idea is that from that healthy anger, they might be able to move towards healthy grieving. And that would be more helpful to the client than experiencing shame. Those of you that are DBT practitioners might see some similarities there about moving a person to experiencing their primary emotion. The next slide there with the heading Greenberg's take on the comparison to DBT is that he ended his talk, and his talk was basically just a broad description of some of the key principles of EFT, knowing that this was an audience that was probably not familiar with it as a therapeutic approach. He ended his talk by discussing what his take of how EFT compares to DBT. And so he says that, EFT works with empathy and activation of the primary maladaptive emotion and transforming it to a primary adaptive emotion. There's some consistency there with DBT in that this is the belief that emotions are fundamentally adaptive, that they occur for a reason, and that there is an adaptive emotion to be had in any experience. It's also, as I mentioned, a consistency with DBT in terms of making the distinction between primary and secondary emotions. But what he says is that EFT has more of an emphasis on the internal experience, and what he says is in EFT you work from the inside out versus a DBT approach, which might be considered more of an outside-in approach, like with the skill of opposite action, where you change your behavior in order to change the way you feel. Greenberg would say you change the way you feel in order to change the way you feel. And so this inside-out approach involves working with underlying painful emotions from loss, trauma, maltreatment, and internalized contempt, where I think that if you're a DBT practitioner and you see that, you might think that is more of a stage two type thing. And I think that that's true, that a lot of what he discussed might be something that you would do more or more likely to do within the context of stage two of DBT when behaviors are under control and now you're working on more of this abject level of misery. But I think what is important and how and what Kelly Kerner talked about when she did her next presentation is to highlight that as therapists we get nervous about how emotionally aroused to let a client go in session, in part because maybe we're afraid of them going into the abyss. And what Greenberg said is that based on his experience, and I believe there's some research to document this, but I can't remember at the moment, he said that moderate to high arousal in session predicts good outcome. So in other words, you want somebody to experience a certain level of emotion if you expect them to get better. That's consistent with the EFT approach. But he also cautioned that you might need to titrate that emotional experience if it gets too high. So you might need to stop and use distress tolerance or other sorts of skills. But what Kelly said in reaction to these comments is okay, is that true? Is it, you know, actually evidence-based that we need to stop when emotional arousal gets too high? Or does the therapist have a particular fear in, of dealing with the client's pain? And so if you go to the next slide, where it's titled Kelly Kerner's Translation to DBT, is what she highlighted is that as a therapist, to not be afraid of actually incorporating some of those EFT principles in DBT and to not be afraid of allowing a certain amount of emotional arousal to happen in session. So she said that one example of using EFT principles in DBT, or at least maybe not an example, but one of the lessons to be learned from EFT is the importance of differentiating emotions, as I mentioned, like talking about adaptive emotion versus maladaptive emotion, primary versus secondary. She said to be mindful of emotion blends, and what you might see in therapy is when somebody describes feeling very upset or has a number of different emotions going on. She was, Kerner talked about a particular kind of client behavior that she feels like she has been seeing a lot recently, which is kind of this this whiny behavior where the person is whining about the difficulty of their life, the difficulty of the situation, and it seems to be a blend of hurt, of anger, of sadness, of disappointment. And Kelly said that EFT has been very helpful for her with that kind of behavioral pattern to help to distinguish the emotions. You know, what's going on there with this person when they're in this state? And then what you want to do is work on strengthening the action urge of the adaptive emotion in the situation. So in many examples, that might be going to the hurt. What are you feeling hurt by? And what do you want to do with that hurt? And really working on that and therefore maybe extinguishing some of the other emotions that might not be so adaptive in that situation. Kelly Kerner also suggested not holding back with sadness and grief, especially when the emotion is productive. As a therapist, you want to ask yourself whether you're fully validating the despair of the client and that the therapist shouldn't avoid sadness out of their own fear of the abyss, because we would not be doing a service to the client if we're avoiding sadness, given that we're hypothesizing that it's important for the client to fully experience emotions within the session. And then her third point was a different way of working on in-session self-invalidation, where we might think the traditional DBT response when somebody makes an invalidating comment about themselves would be to say something like, can you just say that again in a less invalidating way? You know, we might say that that's kind of dragging out new behavior or cognitive restructuring in that moment. What Kelly suggested is just as an experiment to try getting to the heart of what is most painful in that moment instead. So when somebody makes a really critical, self-invalidating comment, I'm such an idiot, that instead of saying, can you say that again in a less self-invalidating way, you could say, what's that like to hear? What's it like to hear that you're an idiot? Which might get more to the notion of validation and assessment. So those two talks, the Greenberg talk and the Kerner talk, I kind of put together as a package. It was an introduction to EFT. Les Greenberg has been extraordinarily productive in terms of books and articles on emotion-focused therapy, and there's a couple that he has out that are in Kelly's slides that were ones that she felt to be most influential for her. And so any of you that might be more interested in learning more about EFT, I encourage you to look to those books. All right, Perry, I'm going to go ahead to research panel. Is that okay?
Perfect. Yeah.
Okay, so in the second half of the morning of Is It DBT, we had an hour and a half set aside for a research panel. We have research panel every year to give people opportunity to present maybe studies that are in progress and preliminary data or new or studies that have just been completed. And so we had three talks this year, and I think that you have a couple, you have access to a couple of them, the Andrew White et al. Talk and the Coons et al. Talk. You, I guess, do not have access to the Dixon Gordon talk. So I'm just going to briefly summarize the three studies and talk about their results before moving on. So the Dixon Gordon et al. Study was entitled DBT Skills Training and BPD Symptomatology, an Examination of the Mediating Role of Emotion Regulation. And so this is Catherine Dixon Gordon with Alex Chapman and Brianna Turner and Chris Walters, all at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. So this is a small pilot study. I believe it's in progress. It's a small pilot study which compared individuals receiving emotion regulation skills training to individuals receiving interpersonal effectiveness skills training to an activities control group. They wanted to examine whether emotion regulation skills training has unique effects on emotion dysregulation compared with DBT, interpersonal effectiveness, and this control group, and also if emotion regulation skills training has wider-ranging effects on other relevant outcomes beyond emotion regulation outcomes. So they had individuals with borderline personality disorder, and they assigned them to one of three six-week groups, and they also had a follow-up. So there was one group that was 6 weeks of just emotion regulation, there was another group that was 6 weeks of just interpersonal effectiveness, and then there was another group that was a control group that was an activities group for 6 weeks. They had a lot of measures that included questionnaires, emotion regulation questionnaires. They also had a person engage in a stressor, a mood induction task, and took physiological indices of emotion state, sort of at the beginning of treatment, at the end of treatment. And they also gave the MEPS, which is an interpersonal problem-solving measure to assess interpersonal skills. The limitations of this study is that they only had six individuals per group so far. So I expect that we're going to hear more about this study. And unfortunately, I was reviewing my slides for this, and their slides did not come out very clearly. You guys don't have it anyway, but just to say, I'm not sure I got the gist of all of their findings. But the preliminary data suggests that the folks in the emotion regulation skills training had overall improvement on a host of measures, and that the emotion regulation skills training seems to target emotion regulation deficits specifically, meaning that those in the emotion regulation skills training group had reductions in emotion regulation deficits that the other groups did not have, but that also the emotion regulation skills training groups seem to have a broader ranging impact, meaning that people in the emotion regulation skills group had saw effects in multiple domains, not just related to emotion regulation. So preliminary data from this study suggests that emotion regulation skills training seems to be a significant agent of change, and perhaps more so than interpersonal effectiveness module. The White et al. Presentation, it was called Group and Individual Variables as Predictors of Graduation from a Dialectical Behavior Therapy Program. This presentation reflects data from the Portland DBT program, which is a freestanding outpatient clinic in Portland, Oregon. And so one of the messages in this talk, which was similar to Cedar Kuhn's talk, had to do with the pros and cons of implementing research into a private practice setting and the difficulty associated with that, but also what can be gained from doing that. So they've been collecting data for a while, and they wanted to examine what predicts graduation, so what predicts completion of DBT in their adult programs. And they gathered information on clients entering the program in 2008 and 2009, and so they had data on 252 individuals. Obviously, they're a large program. Of the 252 individuals that they collected data on, 83% were female, 91% were Caucasian, the average age was 35, and 88% was private insurance. So this is pretty typical, I think, of an outpatient clinic like this. So of these 252 individuals, about 68% of them graduated and completed the program. So then they used a series of regression analyses to determine factors that were related to outcome. And I'm going to just summarize some of the findings that stood out to me as ones that are kind of interesting from a research perspective, but also, I think, clinically relevant. So one thing they found was that the odds of graduation, so the odds of completing the program, dropped by half for every four sessions spent in the pretreatment phase. So basically what they found is that for clients who spent longer in the pretreatment phase, so that phase of treatment before, which is when you're working on commitment to treatment and commitment to the treatment targets, the longer you spent in that phase before you got started with the treatment, the more likely they were to drop out by a lot. They also found that older clients were more likely to graduate, meaning that younger clients were more likely to drop out, which I think is a pretty consistent finding across many different types of treatments. They also found that clients with major depression as a primary Access 1 diagnosis were more likely to graduate than clients without major depression, which I think is also clinically interesting. And then finally, another final point about their presentation that I thought was interesting is that they also looked at what skill module individuals started in when they joined the program and whether this influenced graduation. So they run ongoing groups, which I'm sure many of you do or are aware of, ongoing groups, and so clients can enter whenever they start the program. They might they enter the group, and whatever the group happens to be doing is what they get first. But they looked at it with their data, and they found that there was a trend towards significance. So it wasn't quite significant here, so it's, we need more data. It's just a trend. But they found that folks starting in distress tolerance as their first module were more likely to graduate compared to folks starting into personal effectiveness. That's interesting. I mean, there's not really a lot you can do about it if you have an ongoing program with an ongoing group. You can't always have people start in distress tolerance because otherwise they might have to wait a while to start. But it is interesting and might speak to teaching folks distress tolerance skills when they first start in the program, even if they're not doing that in skills group. That's my own interpretation. Okay. So in the final talk by Cedar Coons, was called Outcomes Measurement in a Small Private Practice of Dialectical Behavior Therapy, a discussion of why and how to do it, and outcomes from 2 years of practice. And so one of the primary rationale for data collection for Cedar and her groups was in part to secure higher reimbursement rates for their DBT programs. And so they were motivated to do it because of that. They used data from 2 DBT teams in New Mexico, both private practice. They included individuals with emotion dysregulation and impulsivity and assessed a total of 93 participants, 55 of whom completed 1 year of DBT. You guys have these access to these slides, and unfortunately I missed an opportunity to get clarification about this before this talk. I'm a little bit confused about why they only had full data on 49 participants, but that's the case. I think one of the interesting pieces is how they collected data that, you know, given that it was all private practice, they don't have a research assistant or an assessment team. So team members were responsible for collecting data from their participants, and they also paid for a statistician out of their own pocket. So basically each team provided money to pay for a statistician to help analyze their data. They used the Beck Depression Inventory, the Beck Hopelessness Scale, and a measure called the CORE-OHM, the Clinical Outcomes and Routine Evaluations Outcome Measure, the CORE, and they found improvements in all measures. And they presented what's amazing about their work, and I think what got the audience most interested, is that they presented their data to insurance companies and got significantly enhanced rates. I, for the life of me, could not remember the exact amount they get paid, but they get paid, I think it's something like $100 per client per group, so therefore a lot more for each individual session. They also get paid per team. And they have insurance companies banging down their doors asking them to be part of their network. And so it was kind of an inspirational talk to a lot of people who are in private practice in the audience about how you can influence these third-party payers by collecting data and showing good outcomes. So that's good. Okay, so we broke for lunch, and then in the afternoon people had the choice of attending one of 3 workshops. And I'm aware that's 8:35, and I also have to get to the to Marcia's annual address. So I'm probably not going to give a lot of time to these workshops. Each of the workshops were 2.5 hours long. So obviously I can't speak to any great length about these workshops. But on the evals that I received for the day, they were all rated highly. I think people really enjoyed the content. So the first workshop was done by Sherry Manning, again, another DBT expert. Sherry has a new book out called Loving Someone with Borderline Personality Disorder, How to Keep Out-of-Control Emotions from Destroying Your Relationship. And this workshop allowed Sherry to teach a lot of the content from that book. The workshop itself was geared towards therapists who work with families of individuals with BPD. I think the book itself is geared towards families of individuals with BPD, but she was giving this workshop gearing towards therapists who might be working with the families and how to coach the families and how to deal with their family member who has BPD. She framed the discussion with the metaphor that of a rose in a tulip garden, and explaining to the family this metaphor of a rose in a tulip garden, where the rose is the person with borderline personality disorder, and the tulip garden is the family. Sherry said that she likes this metaphor because there's not really, most people don't make a value distinction of a rose being much better than a tulip or a tulip being much more beautiful than a rose, like they're both beautiful flowers that people enjoy. But she makes the point about how if you wanted to grow a rose, it requires a lot of care, and you have to, pay a lot of attention to its needs, whereas a tulip does not require a lot of care. They're very hardy and can grow almost anywhere and without a lot of care. And so so she has found this metaphor to be helpful to present to family, because basically what she says is that the family is not equipped or has not been equipped with skills to raise this rose in their family of tulips. And so so part of her message is that with these skills that she talks about in her book, that families can get better equipped to work with their family member. And the frame for her book and the frame for her strategies are the dialectical dilemmas, or the secondary targets that Linehan described in her DBT book, which are a set of six fairly complex behavioral patterns to help the family members identify and respond to problematic behavior. And so it's believed that Sherry was one of the people that was gracious enough to give her slides as handouts to the broader community, so you can have access to that. And you can see how she goes through each of the six behavioral patterns of dialectical dilemmas and talks about what the family member could do when presented with this behavioral pattern. She also came up with a five-step procedure for responding effectively. So this is ways for the family to respond effectively. And so you can see this in the slide, but just to tell you what the five steps are briefly. One is to regulate your own emotions. Two is to validate and to do this at every step with your family member. Three is to ask questions and assess in order to more fully understand the situation. Four is to brainstorm or troubleshoot problem solving. So not to direct the person, not to say you should do this or here's the solution to your problems, but rather to brainstorm with them about the possibilities of what they might be able to do. And then the fifth step, I think, is interesting for me as a clinician to hear this suggestion, is to be sure to get information from the family member about your role and what you could plan on hearing about the outcome. So basically to ask the family member what your role should be rather than assuming them, and also asking them directly if they will let you know the outcome rather than assume that they should let you know, so to kind of make a plan for how they might let you know the outcome of the situation. So giving very short shrift to this 2.5-hour workshop and also this entire book. So my apologies to Sherry.
Shireen, what you're doing for us is letting us know who we should ask to be speakers on the calls.
Okay, great. Yes.
You're setting us up.
I would say the next three people. So Sherry, everybody that gave a workshop would be a great addition to the series, I think.
Oh, terrific.
So moving to Julie Brown. Julie Brown, I think, is just such an interesting example. She attended a DBT intensive training with Charlie Swenson and I believe Cindy Sanderson as the trainers years ago. And she, because people told her that DBT was a great treatment, but Julie has always worked with clients who have, moderate to severe intellectual and developmental disabilities. And what she has done ever since she attended that training was working on adapting DBT for these individuals. And I can't tell you, those of you that are on the DBT listserv probably know that about every 2 months somebody writes in and says, how do I adapt the skills for this subset of my population that doesn't have strong cognitive capabilities and so on. And so Julie has really just done tremendous work in this area. I think she would be a great presenter, Perry. In this workshop, she spent time describing the nature of the client population and the pessimism of most clinicians in working with this population. She used a lot of video clips, which were really endearing video clips of the clients in her program, of sort of describing their day-to-day situations that they struggle with, but then also describing how they use and implement the skills. And it was just very clear from the video examples that they totally get the skills and get how to use them. She talked about the particular problem of cognitive load and the importance of attending to cognitive load, and that people have, you know, different cognitive load capacities, basically how much they can handle cognitively. And for folks with a lower cognitive load, they can only take in so much information compared to folks with a higher cognitive load. And clearly, there's a lot of research to back up these situations. And so, but she just spoke to the importance of choosing and shaping your intervention accordingly, according to sort of the cognitive load capacity of the person you're working with. She made a big point of saying that she has stuck to teaching the original DBT skill set as much as possible, but that she had to make adjustments in her teaching style and in her techniques. But then beyond that, she augmented the original manual with 9 skills, which she calls the skill system. And the skill system are designed to, there are 9, I think I said this, there's 9 skills in the skill system, and they're divided up into skills, 5 skills that you can use all the time, and 4 skills that you can use only when you're calm. And so already you're sort of teaching people first to identify how strongly they're feeling, whatever it is they're feeling, and if it's above a certain level, they can use all the time skills, but they can't use the calm only skills. If they're below a certain level, they can use any one of the 9 skills. And if you see the skills, you'll see that there's a lot of similarities to DBT skills as well, but that they're very concrete skills with a lot of explanation to help the person learn them. She also has a new book, and her new book is called The Skills System Instructor's Guide, an Emotion Regulation Skills Curriculum for All Learning Abilities. I believe you can find it on Amazon. So it's more clearly described, obviously, in her book, the skills system and how it enhances or how it could enhance DBT. Yeah, I believe that she's currently working on evaluating outcomes according to this skills system model. So I encourage you all to look up that book and her work if this describes some of your population. Okay. I thought for sure when I started this that I was going to be finished in a half hour, but here I am. All right. So then just the final workshop I can just summarize in a couple of minutes. This was the Portland DBT group. So it was the same group that did one of the research panel talks, also did a workshop, and their workshop was using DBT to treat teen interfering behavior. You have these handouts, so I think that you can get the essence of their workshop from your handouts, but essentially one of their main points is that even though DBT therapists are trained to be aware of the importance of consultation team as one of the primary modes of DBT, as well as trained to recognize and treat therapy interfering behaviors in individual sessions and in group sessions, that we often avoid dealing with therapy interfering behaviors that arise on team. An assumption that they made, and I think it's probably a valid one, is that therapists are generally avoidant of giving and receiving critical feedback. And so they suggest using DBT principles to get therapists to treat each other on therapy interfering behaviors, for example, orienting to the task, okay, now we're going to be giving critical feedback, teaching skills and how to give critical feedback, and working on decreasing avoidance. And so in their workshop, they had they went through a number of obstacles that can get in the way of this and talked about how you might overcome each of the obstacles in terms of dealing with teen therapy and interfering behaviors. So I liked it as a topic. It's not one that we generally think about in a lot of DBT, but obviously if your team is not functioning well, it's going to have a big impact on your overall program and your outcomes. And so that's why we included that. Okay. So in the last 5 minutes before we go to questions, I wanted to talk about Lenihan's annual address. Not all of it, but most of it was on the topic of certification and accreditation, and so of DBT therapists, the certification and accreditation of DBT therapists and programs. And where are my notes? Okay, I think they are here. So some of you may have remembered that she gave a talk about certification and accreditation that is at DBT probably several years ago, because it's been on her mind to be working on this for quite some time. Now the group has a lot more motivation to do it because it turns out that there's been at least one, maybe two other organizations that are not sanctioned by Lenihan that have recently started programs of certification and accreditation of DBT therapists. And so we can't speak to the quality of those certification and accreditation programs, but Lenihan is very eager to start her own certification and accreditation program. One of the problems has been, and why it's taken a little while to get started, is that there has not been a body that has been willing to take on the task of becoming kind of the accrediting and certifying body. So that is the organization that would do the accrediting and certifying. So at the beginning of the talk, I said that ISA-DBT used to have the sole role of just putting on this conference every year. That is no longer the case. Within the past few months, ISA-DBT has become incorporated as a nonprofit company, and ISA-DBT will become the accrediting and certifying body. There is going to be, and so there's a board of ISA-DBT. I suppose I should say I am fortunate to be the president of that new board. Alan Frizzetti is the secretary. Cedar Coons is the treasurer. But within ISA-DBT, there's going to be a second board, which is going to be the Board of Certification and Accreditation, BOCA, within ISA-DBT. And so what Lenihan did was she just started to outline what some of the steps are going to be for therapists who are interested in getting certified, and I'll tell you about what they're thinking in a second. But also just to note that information can be found on these websites that are listed on my slide here. Starting in February 2012, that's kind of the rollout date. And so if you go to those websites right now, the first one you'll just see out-of-date information, and the second one is at dbt.org. We don't yet have information on certification and accreditation because, as I mentioned, we just got incorporated to do it. But if you routinely check back, you will see information showing up on these slides, sorry, on these websites in a couple of months. So, Perry, do you think it would be helpful for me to just describe what the process will be?
Oh, I think that would be wonderful, yes.
Okay. So therapists or practitioners are going to be able to get certified in one of two roles. They can be get certified as an individual therapist, or they can get certified as a skills trainer. If you are certified as an individual therapist, that means you can also do skills training. But if you are certified as a skills trainer, that means you're certified to do skills training only and not individual therapy. So the requirements for certification, this is, you know, this is as planned, so it's subject to change, I suppose, but it's probably fairly certain at this point. The requirements for therapist certification is that you must have the education and the license to practice as a mental health practitioner. You must have your own mindfulness training and practices and some evidence of that, letters of recommendation, evidence of DBT training and supervised practice experience, but how you get that training could vary. So you might have gotten it in graduate school, or you might get it by going through an intensive training, or you might get it from being on the team with somebody else who was trained. So there's going to be different ways that you might be able to describe your DBT training. And the process for certification is that there will be two different multiple choice exams. One multiple choice exam will assess knowledge of DBT principles, protocols, strategies, and skills. The other multiple choice exam will assess general knowledge of cognitive behavioral therapy. Provided you pass those exams, there will then be an oral exam, which will be a case formulation and treatment planning exam where you have to present a case and describe your formulation and your treatment plan. And then there will also be an adherence coding element. And so as they have it set up right now, or the idea is that if you wanted to get certified as a therapist, you would have to send videotapes of three sessions in a row with one client to the examiner. The examiner would randomly select one of those videos, one of those three, and code it for adherence. And if it's adherent, you pass. If that one tape is not adherent, you get sent all three tapes back and you have to try again. At least that's my understanding of what that method will be. So that's going to be the process for therapist certification. There's also going to be, I'm just going to say in 1 second, there's also going to be a separate process for program accreditation that will require that at least one member of the team is certified as an individual therapist or is certification eligible. Basically, they want to make sure that the program, there's evidence that the program having fidelity to the model. So basically what's happening right now is that the Board of Certification and Accreditation is working on identifying an executive director and working on recruiting an initial body of examiners. It's all going to be volunteer-based. And that beginning in February 2012 is when they're going to start accepting names of clinicians and programs interested in applying. So that's the latest of the late, and who knows, this is 3 weeks ago. I don't know what's changed since then. But that's the latest of the late in terms of certification and accreditation, and really hope that it moves forward in a timely manner at this point. And before we take questions, I do want to say that I am not the best contact person for certification and accreditation issues at this time. So what I suggest if you do have questions about that is just to continue checking with the website and or waiting for the announcement on the DBT listserv or elsewhere about the channels for getting certified. All right. Oh, and then just to say, save the date. We already know when the next is a DBT is going to be. In 2012, it's going to be at a conference center in National Harbor, Maryland, on November 15th, 2012. And the chair for this for 2012 and 2013 will be Dr. Adam Payne, who many of you know is also a DBT expert and trainer. Thank you.
Well, Shireen, this was absolutely wonderful. What you covered in 55 minutes is amazing.
Thank
you. And only for, I'll say, for me personally, whet my appetite to learn more. Could you say a little bit more about the accreditation? Because it sounds as though it's labor-intensive in terms of people to be able to certify programs. Is it not so, or am I accurately picking up to have tapes coded and an oral?
Yes.
That sounds very labor-intensive. Am I right?
Yes, and I think that that's been one of the problems with getting it rolling is just trying to figure out, trying to keep the labor to the absolute minimum, but realizing that it's not possible to let go of certain things like the adherence coding. I mean, one thing that I should point out, at least from my perspective right now, is that not everyone needs to get certified. This has come up because there are certain states with certain third-party payers that won't pay, these enhanced rates for DBT unless there's some evidence that they're providing, adherent DBT. And I think that that makes sense. But if you're not in the position where you are requiring on those third-party payers, at least initially, there's no reason to get DBT certification. I think that, this is my own personal feeling, I think that over time there will obviously become sort of a drive for people to want to get certified, even if they're not dealing with third-party payers, out of a, reputation sort of thing, just to be able to say I'm a certified DBT practitioner. But I think at least initially you know, there are certain states, specifically some Midwest states, where this is really an issue. And so my guess is that there's going to be some sort of system for prioritizing who will be the first folks that get you know, through the application process. Mm-hmm. My guess is that they're going to have to prioritize folks that are in that position where they can't get paid unless they show that they have certification.
Do you happen to know, like, what's the percentage of states that are going that do require this? I mean, is it a high percentage of states?
At the moment, I don't think it's a high percentage of states. I know that I've heard people talk about Minnesota as one. I believe Missouri is another. It's certainly not a high percentage, but my guess is that it will probably move in that direction. You know, if one state can do it successfully, quote unquote, then other states are probably going to, you know, want to follow up with that trend.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting, and you've covered this so well. We do have some questions. They're not per se related to your talk, but do focus on DBT. Do you mind taking some of those?
Sure.
Okay. How can I choose a competent DBT therapist for my teenage daughter? For example, what kinds of questions would be helpful to ask?
I can answer that question by referring you to something else. because I was asked to write up a fact sheet about DBT for the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, ABCT.
Oh.
And on that fact sheet, I actually listed specific questions that I think would be useful to for clients to ask of prospective therapists. So if you go to abct.org and you find their fact sheets, they have some tab for fact sheets, you can find the DBT fact sheet and know that I wrote it and that you can find the questions there that I listed.
Oh, that's terrific. Would you mind sending me a copy and I'll post it on our website?
Sure. I think you can probably post it's sort of owned by ABCT, so I can send you the link and you could post to the link.
That would be great. Oh, you mean okay. We couldn't post it directly. That would be fine.
Okay.
That's terrific. I want to encourage, here's another question. I want to encourage the startup of a DBT team or clinic in my area. What can be done? Is there someone to contact, literature to read?
So is this a professional or a...
This is a professional.
Okay, and they want to start up a DBT program. They're interested and they want to start up a DBT program?
Well, and along with that, I actually did a presentation today someplace, and somebody asked me who does want to get trained but doesn't have a team. Is there a way of finding out where there might be other potential team members?
Yeah, that's a good question, because currently the model for getting intensive training, which is what we think of as the gold standard, you know, just based on what we have, is that you have to come with a team. But, you know, there's other workshops and other, you know, these two-day introduction type things, or even workshops that you put on, Perry, NEABPD, where there might be opportunity to get to know other people in one's area that are doing it. I think that what I would do, actually, if I were a professional interested, is there might be other resources. I just know because I also am a trainer for behavioral tech, so I don't want it to seem like behavioral tech is the only way to go, but it's just the way that I know. Mm-hmm. The behavioral tech website has a directory of people that were intensively trained in DBT, and it's organized by state. And so what I would do and what I tell people to do is go to that directory and just find out who was trained in your state. That doesn't mean that, you know, the folks are still providing adherent DBT or that they provide DBT by the book or whatever, but at least gives you some indication of who in your area might be doing DBT or might be learning DBT. And then I would just get in contact with them and find out what they're up to. And some of them are private practice models, and so they might be interested in having somebody join their team.
Okay, terrific. And here's the last question. Are there data on how DBT does at early ages, for example, 14 to 17, compared to progress of someone who, say, begins therapy at age 35 or older?
So there are not research studies, as far as I'm aware, that compare do folks who start treatment early in life do better than folks who start treatment later in life, if that's the question. I don't know of any study that shows that. There are studies that are under that are going on right now that are looking at DBT for kind of younger age folks. That might be a different question, but there are researchers at Yale that are adapting DBT for children. Mm-hmm. And then there's also researchers at the University of Washington who are adapting DBT to be put into a school curriculum.
Oh, wonderful.
So both of those things, you know, speak to kind of the idea of implementing treatment at an earlier age, but doesn't quite answer the question that person asked.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it's 9 o'clock, and we try to be punctual from both ends. Shireen, thank you so much. This was unbelievable, and I hope, well, I guess once we get the recording up on our website, maybe we'll send out a notice on the DBT listserv, because those people who missed it really should get the opportunity to hear this incredible summary.
Oh, thank you so much, Barry. Thank you.
Thank you for your time and your interest in supporting what we're doing and helping to get more information out there. All right.
My pleasure.
See everybody next week. Thanks again.
Sure.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.